Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path Radio Broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. If you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity, this is a place where you can bring those things up, and we can talk about them together. If you're a listener to the program, or maybe haven't even listened before, but you hear this host say something that is very contrary to what you think is correct, feel free to give me a call and set the record straight. We'll be glad to talk to you about differences of opinion you might have. And that includes the circumstance that you may be a Christian who holds to a different doctrinal or ethical position than the host and wants to make a case. Or you might not be a Christian at all, and you simply disagree with Christianity or you disagree with the Bible and would like to make a case for our listeners and for myself. I'd be glad to talk to anyone who's got any interest along those lines. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. We have only one line open right now. The other lines are full, and we'll be talking to these callers, but you could get onto that one line if you call 1-800-438-5090. One announcement I have, and that is for people in the Santa Cruz area. Now, those who listen to other areas, I know you probably just obviously tune out when I make announcements like this, although I do make announcements from time to time about other areas, because I do actually try to visit all the areas where we're on the radio, and some places where I'm not, where we simply have a lot of internet listeners. But I live in Santa Cruz, and so I have more speaking engagements in Santa Cruz area. Tomorrow night, Wednesday, I'm beginning a four-week series at Twin Lakes Church in Aptos. Now, Twin Lakes Church is a large, the largest church in Santa Cruz County. I think anyone in the Santa Cruz area probably knows where it is. It's in Aptos. It's over near Cabrillo College. But on Wednesday nights, they have, we call them elective classes. Several teachers simultaneously teaching several different classes in different rooms. And usually it's like on a quarter system. But the spring quarter is shorter because of, I think, Easter and other things that break it up. However, there's a four-week quarter beginning tomorrow night. There will be other teachers teaching other classes you might be interested in. If you're interested in my class, I'll be teaching a class for 4 weeks. Mine will be called How Can I Know If I'm Really Saved? And this is going to be an in-depth look at that subject, proceeding from the assumption that there are people who are not saved in the biblical sense of that word, but who think they are and are living with a false assurance. And also that there are people who really are saved, but they're not looking at the right evidences and they have doubts about their salvation. The Bible, especially in the book of 1 John, is very careful to lay out the way to know if you're really saved or not. And it's not totally simple. It's not just a matter of, well, do you believe in Jesus, as many people might think, because even the devil believes in Jesus, but he's not saved. John gives four different tests by which a person could test themselves to see if they are in the faith, if they're really Christians. We'll be looking at those in four successive weeks, beginning tomorrow night at Twin Lakes. Now, this is open to anyone. You don't have to be a member of Twin Lakes Church. In fact, I'm sure they're very glad when people from other places come there and be introduced to the ministry there. The thing I would want to mention is that there is child care available. There's even a meal available if you want to come earlier than the meeting, than the classes. I think the meal is at 5:30, and it costs $3 or $5 or something like that. But if you wanted to come directly from work and didn't have time to fix a meal, you could actually get there at 5:30 and eat. The class is at 6:30. So tomorrow night, Wednesday night, 6:30 at Twin Lakes Church. There is child care. It gets out at 7:45, so you still have most of your evening ahead of you, even if you attend. It's a win-win. So if you're interested in my class or any of the others, I'm not sure what the names of the others are. I don't have them in front of me, but there's usually about 6 or 7 or 8 different classes being offered. Mine is called How Can I Know If I'm Really Saved? And I recommend it if you'd like to come. That's tomorrow night, 6:30, Twin Lakes Church in Aptos. Our lines are full, so let's talk to Homer from Brownsville, Oregon first. Hi, Homer. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Yeah.
Hey, a week or two ago, you were talking to a lady, and I believe it was on the Monday program, And she'd called in with talk about a problem with obesity and, as I understood it, a struggle with gluttony.
Okay, yeah, I think I remember that.
And as I understood, your counsel to her was that her victory over her sin would be a work of God, and it was more or less up to God to give her victory, presumably with her cooperation, of course.
Right, of course.
And was that your position?
Yeah, my position is not quite so simplistic as to say, well, you can't help yourself, so just wait for God to do something, because
uh-huh.
people can wait all their lives and not see God do anything.
Right.
Obviously, we have to be proactive.
Right.
We have to be waging a spiritual warfare, because if we don't wage a warfare, we're not even cooperative with God.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of things the Bible talks about that are related to our sanctification and our warfare and our victory over sin. I didn't go into all of them, but the bottom line is that a lot of times people who are obese or who are struggling with other life-dominating problems, they know it's a sin. They feel convicted. In fact, they not only feel convicted, they feel condemned because they've tried many times to stop. They're trying to please God, as they would see it, by quitting, but they just don't have, it would appear, the strength. And then they live with condemnation. And my position is, you need to faithfully fight it. You need to faithfully obey God as best you know how. You need to, take whatever steps are wise and biblical to overcome life-dominating problems. But in the end, it is God who will give you the victory. And until He does, as long as you're doing all you know to do, you don't have to live with condemnation. That's my position.
Okay. I was curious, what I wanted to ask about this was, it seems to me that in her particular problem, and there could be others, that there is a difference in that, we're told to flee from temptation.
Yes.
And that's one of the steps, one of the things we need to take. And in many cases, that's more or less relatively easy to do. But with something like food, you can't escape temptation.
That's right.
I mean, you got to eat. So,
that's right. If your problem is alcohol, well, you can just avoid places where there's alcohol. But if your problem
right.
is too much food, well, you can't avoid food. You got to eat.
Right. So there would be some difference in certain sins.
Right.
And
well, there'd be different challenges.
Right, different challenges.
Yeah.
Different
mm-hmm.
things we need to do. Possibly different culpability.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's all I wanted to talk about and clarify.
Oh, okay. Well, Homer, it's good to hear from you.
You too, Steve. Hope to see you next time you're up here.
Yeah, that's going to be May 1st.
All righty. Take care.
All right. God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Yeah. For our listeners in Oregon, like Homer is, I go up there once every few months, and my next time speaking in Oregon will be May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can find out at our website what I'm up to there. Let's talk next to Dennis from Independence, Oregon. Dennis, welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I have a question about communion. I was hoping to get your commentary. And my question is, as I read, the story of the Last Supper and when Jesus initiated that, what we now practice as a, kind of a ritual.
Yeah.
I tend to view it more as they were just sitting and eating together. So I wonder if you might have some ideas. Do you think he was intending that we would begin a ritual as Christians to take communion together? Do you think he was more or less just referring to when we're together and we're eating to do it in remembrance of him?
Well, your latter suggestion is certainly something I've considered many times, that, whenever you eat bread and drink, your beverage at your meal, you should do so remembering him who is your spiritual bread and drink. On the other hand, we can't rule out the idea of a ritual, because on that particular occasion of the Last Supper, Jesus and the disciples weren't just having a meal. It's true they were having a meal, but it was a very special meal. It was a ritual meal, actually. It was the Passover, and they did that once a year. And it was so ritualistic, in fact, that there was a very regulated procedure as to, you know, when you would drink from this cup and when you drink from that cup and when you'd eat this matzos off the table, when you'd eat this other thing. It was definitely a ceremonial occasion. Now your question of whether Jesus wanted us to establish such a ritual is a good question, because Jesus did not say that we should establish any new rituals. He did say to his disciples, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup. Now, the introduction of the word this bread and this cup, I think makes it more specific than the generic idea of just eating bread and drinking. But rather, as often as you eat the Passover, as often as you eat the Passover bread and the Passover cup, you do this, he says, in remembrance of me. And, of course, the plain meaning of the statement is as often as the disciples would keep Passover as Jewish people. The Passover was kept only once a year. So there's really nothing in Jesus' statement that would warrant a new ritual that occurred more than once a year. Mm-hmm. And it's not even the case that he's saying you must do this once a year, but rather here are his Jewish disciples who've been keeping Passover every year and will likely continue to do so just because of whatever habit. Whenever they do so, they should remember him. And this would be in contrast to remembering what the Passover traditionally remembered, which was the Exodus.
Yeah.
Now, so it seems to me what all he's really doing is infusing a radically new concept into the observance of the Passover and not really instituting a new ritual at all. Now, the question of whether we should be keeping this annual Passover is kind of separate, because he doesn't say that the disciples must keep the Passover on a yearly basis. He kind of assumes that they will, and when they do, they should remember him. It's a little bit like when Jesus said, when you fast, don't be like the hypocrites. Well, he didn't command us to fast. When he says, when you fast, do it this way, he's just assuming that the disciples will fast. He's not saying they must. There's actually no command in all of the teaching of the New Testament that Christians must fast. But it's kind of taken for granted that they would, and therefore he says, when you do fast, do it this way and don't do it that way. And it seems to me similar to when he says, when you eat this bread and drink this cup, meaning when you take the Passover, don't do it the old way. That is, don't do it in remembrance of the old covenant. Do it in remembrance of the new covenant and what I've established with you. So I could see if Christians would say, well, we believe that we should annually keep a Passover in memory of Christ, but he didn't exactly command it.
Yeah.
You know, and so I would think there'd be room for some difference of opinion about that. Now, when you go beyond even that and say, well, we need to take a ritual cracker and, thimble full of grape juice at certain intervals more frequently than once a year. Well, this is a church tradition. It certainly isn't taught in Scripture, but it's not forbidden either.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, the Passover actually was a full meal. And, what we do when we take communion, of course, is almost never a full meal. It's more like an addendum to a Sunday morning church service, whether we do it, you know, weekly or monthly or every few months. I mean, they're different churches, different denominations have a different kind of schedule for this. For example, the Presbyterians have traditionally taken communion four times a year at three-month intervals. The Baptists, among whom I was raised, took communion once a month on the first Sunday of the month. There are others, like the Roman Catholics, who do it once a week, and or even could do it every day if you wanted. If you're a Roman Catholic, you could take a Mass every day if you want to. But I think you're required to do it at least once a week. But, see, all of these are traditions that are not taught in Scripture. Now, we do find in the Bible one place in the book of Acts where it says that the disciples met on the first day of the week to break bread. But it's not entirely clear whether that means just to have a meal or whether it means to take communion. And it's also not clear that being the first day of the week, that is Sunday, that this speaks of a weekly custom or a monthly custom or anything like that. I mean, they could have just It could have been a special ad hoc gathering since Paul was in town and was leaving the next day. They may have gathered. It may just so happened to have been the first day of the week, and we're told that. But they may have gathered for a meal and for communion to have such a celebration before Paul left town. But there's really not anything in the Bible that I can think of that specifically commands or authorizes the kind of communion that we take on a regular basis. But there's nothing that forbids it either.
Yeah.
I would think that if it's meaningful, if Christians find that it lifts their thoughts to the memory of Christ crucified for us, then, well, anything that does that is probably good, just like listening to a good song about the same subject that, you know, turns your attention to that. But as far as a ritual that's commanded in Scripture, I don't see it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your commentary, Steve, and I'll let you move on to some other callers. I know that your line's been filling up, so do appreciate it. You have a fun day.
Okay, Dennis. Thank you.
Take care.
Bless you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Joe from Las Vegas, Nevada. We also have a line open for you if you'd like to be on the program. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you have a question from the Bible or you disagree with something the host here has said, give me a call. You'd get through right now if you try. 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Joe, thanks for waiting so long. Good to hear from you again.
Oh, but this is my first time.
Oh, different Joe. I have a different Joe who calls from Las Vegas regularly. Go ahead.
I'm a songwriter, and I just wanted to know, like, what kind of assurance or hope or encouragement could you give the mentally ill?
Well, that depends on what we're calling mentally ill. If we're talking about people who are psychotic, dangerous people who are that way because they've experienced some kind of brain injury or have a brain tumor or something like that, or a demonstrable chemical imbalance or something, I would have to say that God knows. I mean, God knows if these people are truly responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
And I would think that just as a little an infant, though they do selfish things, they're not responsible for it because they don't know any better and they don't know what they're doing. I would say that somebody whose mental state, though they are now older, an adult, if their mental state is truly beyond their control and they don't have, you know, the ability to perceive things correctly, that there's a good chance that God, you know, recognizing that, does not hold them any more responsible than he would hold a small child for doing wrong things. But a lot of what we call mental illness is not organically caused. I mean, the general idea that's out there is that if you are schizophrenic or bipolar or, have attention deficit disorder or worse things, you're neurotic, psychotic, or whatever, the general idea seems to be that many people hold by default is that this is a medical condition like other medical conditions. This is, you know, this is no more non-medical than, say, diabetes is. And a lot of people believe that just as a diabetic needs to take insulin because their body is not producing it adequately, so also a person who's bipolar or a person who's who's schizophrenic, you know, they've got a chemical condition and they need to take drugs for that. And basically, these conditions are commonly treated in our generation as if they are medical issues or, you know, physiological problems. Now, some of them may be. I mentioned specifically a brain injury, a brain tumor, perhaps thyroid problems and other physical conditions certainly can mess with a person's mind, can mess with their perception. I mean, all kinds of physical things, well, not all kinds, but a number of physical things may account for a person losing their grip, not being able to deal with reality in the way they normally would be able to. But I think a very large portion of people who are diagnosed as mentally ill, there is no demonstrable physical cause for it. I mean, there may be assumed to be one, but in most cases they have not demonstrated a chemical cause. And if there's no physiological cause, then we'd have to assume the cause comes from somewhere else. And it may be My impression would be that in many cases it's a spiritual thing. And when I say spiritual, that's a large category. It could include everything from being demon-possessed to being merely harassed by evil spirits, or might not even involve demons at all. It might simply be that a person is not maintaining their spiritual life as they should, their faith in God and things like that. So I don't jump to conclusions. And you've asked me about a very large category. You know, how does God feel about the mentally ill? The mental illness, unfortunately, is a catchphrase that is, in our day, generally just assumed to be another sickness. And if people have a sickness, well, you can't blame them for that. You can't blame somebody if they've got diabetes. You can't blame somebody, you know, they have, a medical condition that they didn't bring on themselves. But some behavioral problems, which are diagnosed as mental illness, are probably, well, I would say even certainly, not physiological in their origins, and are the result of people making bad decisions, holding grudges, being fearful when they didn't, when God would wish for them to put their trust in Him, and so forth. So there's a wide range of possibilities there. I think a lot of people have a spiritual condition that they've brought upon themselves, but I'm not going to say which ones because I'm not an expert. All I know, I will say this: when I ran a Bible college for many years, there were many years where students came who had been diagnosed by some mental health professional, as having, you know, one of these conditions, and these students came using medications for them. Now, I never encourage students to go off their medications. I mean, I could get in big trouble for that because I'm not a medical man. But I found many times that the students on medication, when they came to the school, eventually, without asking us or without telling us sometimes, would just go off their medications. They just decided they didn't need them anymore. And they succeeded in staying off of them. In other words, they managed somehow to make decisions in their life. I would say there were spiritual developments in their life that rendered them normal. That, in other words, they didn't need their meds anymore. And that suggests to me that their problem was not chemical in the first place. Sometimes a non-chemical problem can be managed with chemicals, you know, because the chemicals actually do a certain amount of brain damage themselves and actually limit brain activity. But I'm going to just say that when it comes to mentally ill people, if we use that term in the broadest sense, I think God knows if they are personally responsible for their condition or if they are victims of a physiological issue. And I would say in the latter case, God certainly, I think, would give them a lot of grace, just like He would to children who don't know any better to do what they do. But if it's an issue where somebody has just made some sinful choices or some have neglected their spiritual life in their earlier years and as a result have come to be mentally deranged in their behaviors and habits, well, then I think they are responsible for that.
Yeah. Oh, now, what would you say about trauma? People that have been raped, incested, and it causes a subconscious trauma that leads to behavioral problems.
Well, again, I'm not an expert about such things.
Yeah.
And trauma, it's very possible that certain kinds of trauma do create a physiological condition in the brain. I'm not sure. I mean, for example, we know for a fact that certain experiences people go through, crises and so forth, can cause adrenaline to increase. Now, that's a chemical issue. Now, that doesn't usually result in mental illness, but we know that, you know, excitement or fear or whatever can influence the amount of adrenaline in your system at a given time.
True.
Now, if that's true of adrenaline, it might also be true, for all we know, of certain other chemicals. I'm not sure. Now, they have done, and people have pointed this out to me who disagree with me many times, they've done these brain scans where they can show that a person who's depressed, there's a certain area of their brain that is, you know, showing up a different color than the other parts of the brain. Or if somebody's schizophrenic, it's another part of their brain. And they can say, see, we've identified a physical cause for these behaviors. And I would say, well, maybe you have, and maybe you haven't. I mean, the fact that a person's brain is behaving differently when they are themselves behaving differently doesn't tell us which came first, the chicken or the egg. I mean, is it this difference in their brain that's causing their behavior, or is it their choices and behavior that's causing this difference in their brain? Since we do know that certain moods and so forth can trigger physiological conditions in people, we just don't. It's still a very mysterious science.
Yeah. Now, what did they mean when they said Jesus had a demon, the Pharisees and Sadducees?
Well, they were referring to the fact that he was obviously operating in the miraculous realm, particularly in his casting demons out of people. They said he was casting out demons by the power of a demon, Beelzebub, and it was the best way they knew how, without acknowledging him to be who he claimed he is.
Yeah, yeah.
That is their best way of explaining away the miracles that he was doing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was not really a very honest appraisal.
Yeah, I see. All right, well, thanks, Steve.
Okay, Joe.
Have a great day, and I enjoy your show.
Thanks. I wish I knew more about the subject you asked about, but I mean, it's not something I haven't studied. I have studied for many years, off and on, that subject, because it interests me and it concerns me, but there's still many questions unanswered in my own mind.
Yeah, I think the trauma thing, because I suffer panic disorder, and I think a lot of it's from trauma, because when I met the Lord, I was slain in spirit, and I called upon the Lord in repentance, and I've been delivered from 6 addictions. So, I mean, I know the Lord is real, and I know he's working in my life. But on the other hand, you know, I have to take my medicine for panic disorder and stuff like that that was due to related traumas in my childhood.
Well, if you've overcome 6 addictions and this is what's left, I'd say often God's work in our life is conquering one enemy at a time. You know, and it looks like he's conquered most of yours.
That's great, Steve.
All right. God bless you, Joe.
God bless you, Tisty. Have a great day.
All right. Good talking to you. Another caller from Las Vegas, Tony from Las Vegas. And if you'd like to be on the air, we have time for you, probably 20 or more, 25 minutes left of the program, and lines open at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. Tony, thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, listen, I got a question. I'm going to take it off the air so I can take some notes on it, okay? It's about, I think it's Psalms. It's a classic that, you know, they always do at the funerals, the shadow of death, and, you know, but when I try to read it and understand it, I don't associate it with why everybody does it at funerals.
Okay, so you're talking about Psalm 23, which is the shepherd's psalm, and he says, "Lo, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me."
That's the one. Why do they always use those at a funeral? Am I misunderstanding the thing?
No, you're probably not misunderstanding. It's possible that they are. And you said you didn't want to stay on the air, so I won't make you do so, but if you want, we can still dialogue about this.
Yeah, I can stay on. I used to want
okay.
to get a better reception. But yeah, because I want
sure.
to take, I want to know which ones you're reading. I want to write them down so I can.
Well, sure.
Go ahead.
I don't know if I'll say much. I don't know if I'll say much that you need to write down, but you can decide that. I think the main issue here is what does it mean when David says, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." Apparently, when this is used at funerals, they are assuming that walking through the valley of the shadow of death means passing through the experience of death itself, actually dying, you know. And so that David was saying, even though I die, you are with me. Well, David may have believed such a thing, and it may be true, in fact, but I don't know that that's what he's saying. It sounds like he's talking in the context of being a sheep following his shepherd, and that the shepherd leads him sometimes through dangerous pathways, including through valleys where the prospect of death hangs over them. That is a place that would be extremely dangerous for a sheep to go if not well protected, perhaps because mountain lions or wolves or whatever might be in those mountains, passing through those valleys, that's where the shadow of death is hanging over them. That is, I would take that to mean not death itself, but the threat of death, the fear of death. And he says, if I pass through valleys like that, I don't fear, because you're with me. In other words, I have a shepherd who takes care of me. He says, your rod and your staff comfort me. I take that to mean when we pass through such dangerous situations, I'm comforted by the fact that you have a rod and you have a staff and you're on my side. That is, a shepherd is well armed to protect his sheep against predators. And so I don't think there's necessarily a reference to dying there, although you're right. It is often, when preached on, it's often assumed that David is talking about, though I die, you're still with me, and therefore I don't fear the idea of going through death. But I think in the context of him saying, the Lord is my shepherd, and he leads me beside still waters, and he caused me to lie down in green pastures, and sometimes even through the valley of the shadow of death. But even then, I won't be afraid, because you're still my shepherd, and because you have a rod, and you have a staff, and you're quite able to take care of me, even in life-threatening circumstances. And David knew that well enough, because he had been pursued by King Saul and his armies for many years, and David, with a small band of loyalists, had to flee and were very close to death. At one point, he said death is only one step away from him. But he knew that God was with him, and therefore, even though he lived, with his life hanging in the balances a great deal in that period of time, he could be confident in the fact that he was not alone, that God was with him, as he said.
Oh, so I'm understanding. You said it was Psalms. What number is it?
That's Psalm 23.
23. So when they do it at funerals, right after, when you're about to put the person in the ground and all that, it's a nice sounding sermon for that activity.
That's true. I mean, I think they use that partly because that psalm is very comforting in general to Christians, and because it mentions death. Although I think the phrase that it mentions death in makes death not the subject. It's, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. In this case, death is simply the object of a preposition. It's the shadow. The valley is, has shadows or threats of death,
right,
it would seem to me, hanging over it. So I don't think David is specifically talking about dying. On the other hand, I mean, if you'd asked David, well, what about dying itself? Are you afraid of that? He might have also said, no, I'm not afraid of that either, because God's going to be with me there too. But I don't think that's what he's saying in this particular verse.
Okay. I think I understand it much clearer now.
Okay, Tony.
I really appreciate it.
I appreciate your call. God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you.
Bye now. All right. Well, our lines have all cleared now. We've got about 20 minutes almost left, so if you want to give me a call, this is definitely time you can get on. 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. I received, I think it was last week, yeah, it was just sometime within the past several days, an email from Mary in Orange County, and she wrote this. She said, in Christian news media today, and I don't know what day that was, but sometime last week, in Christian news media today, it was reported that, and she names a prominent Christian minister, I won't give his name here, partly because I can't confirm or disconfirm the story, and I don't want to pass along gossip, but let's just, the question, is still valid without knowing the name of the minister. She gives the name of the minister. It was reported that so-and-so, a well-known Christian minister, told Larry King on his show last night that he had never endorsed California's Proposition 8, which defines marriage as only between a man and a woman. However, there is clear video evidence to the contrary on YouTube, which shows Pastor so-and-so, the same man, specifically telling members of his church to vote for Proposition 8. Now, okay, in other words, so the man did tell his congregation to vote for Proposition 8, and yet he, on Larry King's show, he said that he had never endorsed Proposition 8. Okay, now she continues. When you have a pastor with the kind of national recognition and influence that he has, obviously lying, what do we as Christians do about it? Do we mind our own business because he's not our pastor? Do we pray for him? Do we confront him as members of the body of Christ? Or is he above criticism? Is he a wolf in sheep's clothing? The bottom line is, what do his church members do versus those who are not his church members when they see this man blatantly lie and apparently for political reasons? Well, the reason I don't want to give this man's name over there is that I am unfamiliar with the specific case. I did not hear the context of his statements to Larry King. And I'd be very cautious about saying he blatantly lied. It does seem that it'd be hard to harmonize what he said to his congregation with what he said to Larry King. Perhaps not impossible to do. I don't know. In his own mind, he may have felt like, well, when I tell my congregation that they ought to vote for this, it's not the same thing as using my national platform to endorse the proposition. That may have been what he was thinking. I'm just giving the man the benefit of the doubt, because frankly, I don't know him. I'm not a follower of his ministry, though I have heard him interviewed before, and he strikes me as a Christian man. And as a Christian brother, I think he deserves the benefit of the doubt from me. But, you know, it is possible that he considered that what he said to his congregation is not the same thing as what he was in his own mind referring to on Larry King as an endorsement. Because this Christian man is a national figure. He's got a national audience. And it may be that since he never got on the, the national television and endorsed that proposition, that he felt that he had never endorsed it in the sense that he would be capable of doing. I don't know. I mean, it's possible he's fudging on the truth, but it's to call it a blatant lie is a less generous judgment than I would prepare to give him. I do know this, that, when you're on Larry King, and I don't know this from myself, I've never been on Larry King, but when you're on national television, and you're trying to watch your words, and you're trying to not give the wrong impression. Sometimes any man, and I would say a Christian man or others, might be a little more politically correct than he would be privately with his friends. And that's not, I'm not saying he should be. I'm saying that would be a tendency. And the man himself may have, you know, if we sat down and said, well, what did you mean in this statement, what did you mean in that statement? It may turn out that he'd say, well, you know, I actually was just being dishonest with Larry King. Or he might say, well, in my own mind, I was thinking that what I said to my church and what I said to Larry King had different context, I meant endorsement in a different way. And you might still say, well, even if he says that, it still seems kind of fishy. But I guess I'd have to say this. I try to be an extremely honest person. I try not to ever lie. But there are times when speaking about the same situation, I would speak of, I would define a term differently in one context than in another. And one could possibly take, I can't think of any instances offhand, but I'm sure that if you took everything I ever said on record, you could find some statements which, taken in isolation, would sound like they contradict statements I made in isolation, taken in isolation some other place over the years. In some cases, I really have changed my mind, and there really would be a contradiction. But there'd be other cases where, and I've known there have been, but I just can't remember specific cases, where people misunderstood or they did not understand one statement the way I intended it. And they could easily say, well, that looks like a contradiction. And, you know, if we sat down and I explained it and so forth, they might accept my explanation, they might not. But in this case, you're asking, well, what if a guy does blatantly lie? I would say that if a man who professed to be a Christian blatantly and unmistakably sins publicly, that the church should call for his repentance. And if he doesn't repent, they should do something to publicly distance themselves from him, because there is in the Bible discussion about the issue of church discipline. I would say in this man's case, though, because he is such a public figure and he is so well known, he gets a lot of criticism from a lot of different sides. And it's hard to be visible to over, you know, maybe 250 million people on a regular basis and never say anything that somebody could interpret as, you know, a contradiction or a lie or something like that. So I guess I'd have to say I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt until I have a chance to hear him explain the discrepancy. And that's maybe just that's what I would want people to do for me. And of course, I'll never be as public as he is, and you won't be either. But if anyone, if as many people were examining critically everything I said and everything you said, publicly or privately or whatever, I'm sure it'd be hard to avoid offending somewhat. I mean, James said, you know, in many things we all stumble, and he specifically said, if anyone does not stumble in speech, that person is a perfect man and able to bridle the whole body. James indicated that stumbling in speech is one of the things that's particularly prevalent among us, and James even included himself. So I'm not a follower of this particular man's ministry, but I think we need to judge him as graciously as the facts will allow. And maybe having heard both the statements that, as you have, maybe you'd say, well, the facts don't allow a charitable judgment in this case. I have not heard the statements, and so I'm going to hold out for a more charitable judgment until I know otherwise. That'd be my position on this. Let's talk to Larry from Las Vegas, Nevada. That makes a third call from Las Vegas in a row, and we've got another one waiting online, too. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I'm a taxi cab driver here in Vegas.
Great.
And I have your program on about 3 of the afternoons during the week, and you'd be surprised the number of people that get really shocked that here's a cab driver and listening to a religious show.
Yeah, and they're probably really shocked by what the religious show actually says, too.
Oh, yeah. We get some great discussions, and I've even led some people to the Lord in my taxi cab because of it.
That's great.
Well, I had an oddball the other day give me a comment that I'm not a theologian. I'm a cab driver. I couldn't answer it. It sounded good, but I didn't have a clue. And
okay.
It's this. He said that the Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the Mary, the son, the wife of Cleophas, in his opinion, were the very same Mary. That the word Cleophas meant replacer, and that he felt that the reason that they had the same names of their children and were listed in the same spot was that they were actually the very same person, and that it was one of those, I think he called it a Levite or Leverite or some kind
Levirate marriage.
In Matthew.
Yeah.
Do you think there's anything to that? And then I had one other question.
Well, I don't. First of all, it is interesting that Mary, the mother of Cleophas, did have children by the same names as those that are listed as the brothers of Jesus in the scripture. And I'm sure that this man is not alone in reaching the conclusion that it's the same Mary. But I would advise some caution about that conclusion because, first of all, Mary was the most common name in Israel in those days. I mean, there's been demographic studies based of names of the period based not only on the Bible, but from all the literature that has survived from that various period in that part of the world. And as far as popular names go, there's Mary, approximately one woman in four was named Mary in the population. I mean, that's one thing. And then also the names of the sons, Simon, Joseph, Simon, Joseph, some of the names escape me, but they are all extremely common Jewish names. And so it wouldn't, if approximately one woman in four in Israel in those days was named Mary, that'd be probably hundreds of thousands of Marys. And that two of them might have sons that have the same names, especially when all those names are extremely well-known names, you know, James and Joseph and Judas and Simon are the names. All of those are extremely popular names because almost all of them are the names of the tribes of Israel. I would say that the parallel is not sufficient to prove the point. Now, I would also say it could not be a case of Levirate marriage Because in the case, the suggestion is that Joseph died, and this man Cleophas married Mary and had these children, right?
Yeah.
But that Cleophas must have been Joseph's brother, because under the law, if a man married and died childless, his brother was to take the widow and raise up children for his deceased brother. But the trouble here is that even if Joseph did die just after the birth of Jesus, it would not be a situation where Joseph had died childless, because although Jesus was not his organic or his biological son, he was regarded to be. No one but Joseph and Mary would believe that Jesus wasn't his son, and therefore Joseph did not die childless, as far as anyone was concerned. You know, his brother would not have to marry Mary, because there was already an heir in the family, Jesus, the son of Joseph.
Well, I had never heard such a thing, and I didn't even have a clue for an answer. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Now, you had a second question, you said?
Yes. Now, being a cab driver, you know, when you drive a cab in this town, there's not anything you don't see. You just get used to everything.
I guess not, yeah.
I haul a lot of the fellas to strip clubs, and the strip clubs give us cab drivers big kickbacks. Now, I call it my sex money. And I made an agreement years ago with the Lord that I give that money away. And I've helped in a lot of projects, different things, and I use it for some of my church money, and I use it for special youth projects and everything. I had a fella I gave $300 to last week, and he refused to take it because it was sin money. Comment on that, and I've never sent y'all a contribution. Would you take some of that? There you go.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you regarded it to be money that you earned doing something wrong, then I would have qualms about taking it, because, you know, in the Old Testament, and this is just a principle, it's not a law we're under, but it may show something of God's attitude. In the Old Testament, it said that you shall not bring the price of a prostitute to the temple of the Lord. And what that seemed to mean is if a woman made money as a prostitute, she should not take the money from that and give it to the temple. Presumably, it was tainted. Okay. Now,
I get a lot of prostitutes, and I've had some of them that we have a ministry here for the
sure.
girls that want to quit, and I've had some of them that I've taken down there to there, and we've had professions of faith from them.
Yeah. Well, let me say this, Larry. Let me say this. I don't think that driving a prostitute as a taxi cab driver, or driving somebody who's going to use a prostitute. I don't think the cab driver is sinning in that case. Your job. Your job is just to transport whoever wants to go wherever they want to go. It's their decision, not yours, where they're going. And therefore, if there's something sinful about what they're doing, that's their sin, not yours. It's a little bit like paying our taxes. You know, what if the government does something sinful with our money? Well, that's their problem. You know, by paying our taxes, there is an obligation to pay taxes biblically. And we are not supposed to withhold our taxes simply because the government might take what we give them and do something wrong with it. Once we've paid our taxes, the government and the officials who abuse it are the ones responsible for what they do with it, it seems to me. And, I mean, in the Bible, Jesus suggested that they should pay tribute to Caesar. Well, a lot of the money that was paid to Caesar was used for sinful activities, but paying the tribute was not a sinful act. And I think that when you're doing your job, you're doing a legitimate job. You're not dealing drugs. You're not running a strip joint. You're just driving people wherever they want to go. If they want to go to some place that you wouldn't want to go and wouldn't approve of going, you're not sinning by taking them there. And I don't think the money that you make on those excursions is sin money. But here's the thing. If you thought it was, if you thought, well, I'm sinning, but I'm going to take the money I make sinning and I'm going to give it to God, then I would say that very fact that you would think of it as sin money would make it tainted.
Well, to be honest, that it doesn't really bother me. I kind of use it.
Yeah.
You know, I look at it as associating with the sinners, and when I get a chance, I witness to them. You know.
Well, good
and,
for you.
And consequently, I have a lot of friends because of it, and a little
sure.
bit of influence, because I don't judge them.
Sure.
It ain't my
well,
business.
Larry, I'd love to talk to you more, but I only have about 3 minutes left, and I have another caller, and he wanted to get in, but
well,
I
love the ministry, brother. brother, and I want you to know that every once in a while you got people listening that would never listen, and they listen in my cab.
I'm glad to hear it, Larry. Sounds like you're doing a good work.
Thank you, brother.
God bless you. Bye-bye now. Okay, we're going to take one more call, also from Las Vegas. This is Dave from Las Vegas. Thanks for waiting, brother.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, regarding Colossians 1:10, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. Regarding the Rick Warrens and the Osteens on Larry King Live, do you believe that God has ordained them to give the gospel when they get an opportunity like that?
Well, let's start with the assumption that these men are called of God to be in the ministry. I assume that is true of Rick Warren. I don't know Joel Osteen's ministry enough to know if that's true with him, but perhaps so. Let's just say, given the assumption that these men are called upon by God to be his ministers, or even for that matter, to just be Christians, then given the opportunity to give a witness to the nation on something like the Larry King Show, I would think that there would be an obligation to at least speak the truth and to speak up for Christ as the occasion permits. On the other hand, if the interview was such that it gave them virtually an opportunity to say anything about Christ, then I wouldn't feel like if I were them, I wouldn't flog myself over the fact that I had no opportunity to say anything about the gospel because the interview was run by somebody else who didn't allow that. But I think that any true Christian, whether they're a minister or not, any true Christian should jump at the opportunity, if they have it, to testify for Christ on national television or radio or whatever.
Okay, well thanks, Steve. I watch those programs a lot, and I'm always rooting for these guys to put forth the word and somehow even, because Rick Warren was on even on Resurrection Week, and they don't seem to mention it, and I'm not sure if they have to sign something or they're just avoiding the issue. But Larry gives them opportunity a lot of time in his questionings, and they don't come across with Christ on the cross, the blood, redemption of sin, or any of that.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to say that when a minister is in that situation, we can all say, well, if I were him, I'd certainly bring this up or I'd bring that up. But there's probably in their own mind a list of 100 things that under the circumstances, if circumstances allowed, they'd like to bring up. But they have to pick and choose the things that they really think are what God would have them say in the few minutes they have. And no doubt, whatever they choose to say will disappoint some of the Christians watching, saying, well, I think he should have spoken more on this or that. Sometimes it may be that they are not using it as a straightforward evangelistic podium. That is, you know, they're not going to give an altar call on the Larry King Show, but that they may be hoping to simply rehabilitate the way people look at Christians in general in a society which thinks very badly of Christians. So maybe they're trying to chip away at something rather than blast it away with dynamite at that time.
Okay, Steve. Thanks for your insight. God bless.
Thank you, David. God bless you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're a daily broadcast, Monday through Friday, for an hour a day in the afternoon, 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. We are listener-supported. There are no paid staff. There is no paid host on this program. The only people who get paid are the radio stations and the phone company for the 800 number. But it costs a lot of money, and if you'd like to help us pay the bills, we don't have any sponsors. We don't take commercial breaks. We don't sell anything. We just trust God, and maybe God will trust you to help us out. You can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address at our website. You can find many resources free of charge at our website, Nothing for Sale. Also, my speaking schedule is there. I'll be speaking at Twin Lakes Church tomorrow night in Aptos. Check it out. It's thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.